Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today I'm talking about the third of four myths that I'm describing about change, what we believe about change, and how believing these myths gets in our way and keeps us from doing the things that we want to do. And I'm playing the second half of my interview with the amazing and remarkable Betty Garrett. So hang on, here come the show. Welcome to The Lynn Show. Here we are on the last week of the first month of the new year. And if you were listening to this show, the first show in January, you heard me talking about New Year's resolutions and how they can be problematic and even actually work against us. So, did you make New Year's resolutions? How are you doing? I would love to hear, so if you feel like reporting on your progress, please go to my website, thelynshow.com, and click on Contact Me and tell me how you're doing. Today I'm going to talk about myth number three. I've been talking about the myths that we believe about change and how they are problematic. And then I'm also going to play the second half of my interview with Betty Garrett. I can't even think of superlatives that are good enough for Betty Garrett. And, of course, Betty worked with everybody in the entire world. And if you were listening last time, you heard her talking about Martha Graham and Orson Welles and Frank Sinatra and Gene Kelly. And in this interview, she's talking about the Blacklist, the McCarthy-era Blacklist. She's talking about her career on stage and screen, or her TV career, working for Norman Lear. But that will come next. First, I'm going to talk about myth number three, which is actually related to the problems that we have with New Year's resolutions. This is one of the reasons that New Year's resolutions are so problematic. I do a lot of work with companies, businesses, boards of directors, organizations as opposed to individuals. And when I speak about organizational change, which is what I mostly get hired for, I call my speech, "People are not furniture." People are not furniture. You would think that this would be self-evident, but it is not. And of course, what I mean by that is you can pretty much move furniture around wherever you want it, and it'll be fine. But you cannot do that with human beings. So if you are merging or blending or taking over or buying another organization, or you're downsizing, or you're redoing the physical plant, or you're shifting the management team, or as in one huge organization that I worked with, they decided that they were going to shake up the different departments. So they took half of a department and made it part of another department. They took managers from one department and made them managers in another department. They took people and moved them out of wherever it was they were working and put them someplace else. They broke up entire departments or made them disappear. This is the sort of thing that management does when it decides that it's somehow in the best interests of the organization. Usually they mean the bottom line. So when they do these sorts of things, they make sure that the financial, the legal, all these administrative concerns are taken care of. And then when all of that stuff's in place, they say to the human beings who have to actually do the change, "Okay, everybody, change." You know, as though it's musical chairs. Well, of course, human beings do not change like that because they are suddenly told that now you don't work with this person, you work with that person, and now you don't work in this environment, you work in that environment, and now you don't work with that software, you work with this software. There's a bank in my neighborhood that has changed, I don't know, four times. And every time, the same people work in this bank every time the new bank buys them or takes them over or something. And every time the computer system changes, these people are just crazed. I try and explain to management that if you take a chair and a table and you move it from a place where it had four walls around it and it was self-contained, and then you put it in the middle of a room where there were lots of other chairs and tables and no boundaries, the chairs and the tables don't care. But the people who have to sit at those chairs and tables, they do care. If you put Word in a particular computer, and then you change your mind and you put Word Perfect in that computer, the computer doesn't care. But the person who has to work that program does care. That person has a learning curve. That person has a comfort zone. Human beings do not change on a dime. Human change requires process. We are process-oriented beings. This is why telling yourself that you have not worked out in a year, but now you're going to work out a half an hour every day, is probably going to be hard to do. So, recognizing that human beings require process for the most difficult changes, for the ones that really shift the comfort zone, for the ones that really require new skills, or a change of attitude, or increased self-confidence. Those changes cannot be made by mandate. They cannot be made by command. They cannot be made by demand, even if the person demanding is ourselves. So when you think about, and maybe you're thinking now, about a change that you want to make. Maybe you've been complaining about the house you live in, or a room in the house, or the state you're living in, or the people you're living with for a very long time. Maybe you have been saying over and over and over and over again, I have to get out of here. I have to change this. I have to do something about this. Simply demanding it of yourself will probably not be enough. As I was talking about last week, there are consequences to changes, often unintended or at least unexpected consequences. So in the organizations that I often work with, you know, they do all this legal and financial stuff, and then they tell the people to change, and of course the people don't change. What they get is rebellion. What they get is lower productivity. What they get is people fighting with each other. They get a lot of acting out. This is, yet again, the law of unintended consequences. Unintended consequences. This is not what the people intended, but a lot of these things simply do not work. I did some work for a while with people who were transferred out of country with their families, who, by the way, are called the trailing spouse. It's so attractive. You know, companies spend a tremendous amount of money to relocate someone to another culture, and most of that is a waste because they don't do the work of helping the families prepare for the move, and they get a whole lot of unintended consequences. So, are you thinking about a change you really want to make? Have you been ordering yourself? Or are you thinking of a change that you'd like someone else to make? And have you either been saying to yourself, what the hell is the matter with them? Why don't they just do it? Or even saying it to them? Please, take a moment to consider the possibility that human beings require process, not orders. That would be true for you and for anyone else that you wanted to change. And begin to ask yourself, what process might be required for you? If you listened to last week's show, you might be asking yourself, what might the unexpected or unintended consequences of this action be? You know, the name of my book is When You Can, You Will. And, of course, that means that until you can, you can't. So I'm hoping that as I talk about these myths, you are having an opportunity to revisit whatever it is that you've been trying to do and give yourself a little break and begin to think about such things as unintended consequences, comfort zone, learning curve, and what might be getting between you and the change you want to make. Well, okay, as you're doing that, I am going to introduce the second part of my interview with the remarkable Betty Garrett. I did this interview last year. In May of this year, Betty will be 90, and she's still working. Role models don't come any better than Betty Garrett. Before I play the second part of the interview, I'm going to play a cut from a CD that came out with many of the songs that Betty recorded over the years. And this one is called Any State in the 48 is Great. And it's Betty Garrett and, will you believe, Jimmy Durante. So I'm going to play that, and right on the heels of that, you will hear my interview with Betty Garrett.
Any state in the 48 is great.
You're so right, James.
So let's appreciate that any state is a reason we should celebrate. Carry on, Betty.
You know, you really rate in any location throughout the nation, happiness can be found.
From border to border, the things are in order, so tip your hat to your home ground.
See that little twinkle up in the blue.
Old Glory set aside a special star for you. So take a trip and it will demonstrate.
That's an awfully big word for you, Jimmy.
That any state in the 48 is great.
There's the Hoosier State, the Buckeye State, the Badger State, and the Hawkeye State.
And how about Louisiana, a part of Americana?
Betty, they'd be back in Louisiana at Mardi Gras time.
Jimmy, that's Mardi Gras. The S is pronounced ah, as in pâté de foie gras, Vichy soir.
Well, in that case, let's go sit on the gras and have a glare of sassafras.
Well, that's better.
Thank ya. Any state in the 48 is great.
Great, great, great.
So let's appreciate that any state is the reason we should celebrate.
Well, let's celebrate. You know you're really ready in any location throughout the nation.
Happiness can be found.
Look around. From border to border, the things are in order. So tip your hat to your home ground.
There's the Lone Star State, the Granite State, the Empire State, and Magnolia State.
Georgia,
Washington, Arkansas, Idaho,
Texas,
New Mexico.
And how about with a cattle freely roaming?
If you're looking for a place to make your home in,
why not Wyoming?
The Bluegrass State,
Cotton State,
the Golden State,
Sunflower State.
See that little twinkle up in the blue.
Old Glory set aside a special star for you. Don't take a trip, and it will demonstrate.
Jimmy, I think you convinced me.
That any state in the 48 is great.
Okay, so, then what happened with you?
Well, you mean after the blacklist?
Yeah.
Well, it was very interesting. I had made, by that time, I had made, most people think I made a lot of pictures. I only made 7 pictures in my life.
You know, I saw Our Town last night.
Yeah, somebody told me it was on.
Yeah. It's great.
Yeah, that I love that. That doesn't hurt my heart at all, as I don't get any residuals from it at this point. But, you know, it keeps my image up there.
Oh, God, yes. And you know, the, you know, it's on TMC. And
yeah.
And then they did Singin' in the Rain after it. And,
yeah.
But they said that Gene Kelly said that was his favorite movie that he ever made, was On the Town.
Yeah, well, it was his first director's job.
Oh.
And he really had the control of it. And mm-hmm. And that was, you know, it was a groundbreaker, that show.
Boy, it
that
sure movie. Was.
Yeah, I loved it. It holds up pretty well.
Yeah, it does.
But, you know, I'd made 5 movies at Metro. And then I'm trying to think. Well, the blacklist started, but Larry's actual appearance started later. But it was beginning to influence our careers. And I got my sister Eileen. Mm. Larry and I we went to Europe. That's what we did. We went to England, mm-hmm. And we would tour the provinces. We went about 3 times, and we had the most wonderful time. Mm-hmm. We put together a variety act, which we did in the United States, too. Strangely enough, we played twice in Las Vegas. There was no such thing as a blacklist in Las Vegas, which always strikes me funny. And we played there, and we did theaters. In those days, they used to have a movie, and then they'd have a vaudeville show.
Mm-hmm.
And then the movie would go on again. And sometimes we would do 4 shows a night.
Wow.
Or a day, actually, would start. And so we did a series of those. we kept doing things, you know, like building a variety act, mm-hmm. a vaudeville act, they call it here in Great Britain, they call it variety. And we were able to take that and we were able to play the Palladium, which was, you know, and we played all over England and Scotland. We never got to Ireland, but, you know, we did that over a period of years and we stayed, and we did a lot of summer stock. Back east, the stage was not affected by the blacklist the way the movies were. A lot of actors who were blacklisted were able to work in shows. Mm-hmm. But we did a lot of summer stock. I think we did every summer stock show that exists. And that was a lot of fun. Larry and I loved working together. Mm-hmm. It was, a lot of couples don't like it, but...
It's another interesting twist. Yeah. Probably had the blacklist not happened, all that wouldn't have happened.
Absolutely. I realize now that I would have been stuck at Metro probably until now. And it's funny, when, I don't know whether you know this story, that I was up for Annie Get Your Gun.
No.
And Dory Sherry by that time was ahead of Metro. And this was another thing that Lou advised me about. And people said, oh, you know, he ruined your career.
Because you could have gotten that.
Well, the thing was, they wanted to, actually they wanted to even cut my salary lower than I had been getting and have me sign another 7-year contract. Now, Larry had just gone through this with Columbia about the Jolson story, where they made him sign another 7-year contract. And that means they've got your life.
That's right.
For, you know, I already had 4 years left on my contract.
So there would have been another 7 in addition to the 4? Or it would have just been 7?
It would probably have started then. I can't even remember. But the point is that they had plenty of time to make money on me.
Right.
But why? That was their policy to do that. If they gave you a big plum, you had to sign another 7 years. And Lou wouldn't let me do that. And I was agreed with him, too. And I remember a conversation. Dory Sherry was a man I liked very much, and I thought he was lovely. But he said to me, he said, Betty, he said, we have people who have spent their lives here in the studio and they're very happy. I mean, people like Spencer Tracy, and you know, Spencer Tracy became an old drunk.
Yeah.
And and I said, I know what happens with this, Dory. I said, I sign this contract and then a couple of years go by and I don't have any really good pictures. Then a nice plum comes along.
Oh no, and then you have to
and
sign for
make me sign another 7-year contract. And Dory said, with a straight face, said, oh, we wouldn't do that to you. I said, what do you mean you wouldn't do it to me? You're doing it to me now. But, you know, that was their, I call them the big muckamucks.
Yeah.
That was their kind of reasoning. So anyway, what happened, I had an agent at the time from the William Morris office, and he kept saying to me, you stick to it, you stick to it. They want you, so you stick to it. Don't worry. Well, the next thing I know, Betty Hutton got the part, and handled by the same agent.
Oh, you're kidding.
And Betty Hutton was making a much bigger salary than I was at the time, so it's understandable why the agent would rather have Betty
10% of that than 10% of yours, right?
So, I don't know. It's one of those ironies. But I've thought about it so often. I thought, if I had signed that contract, if I had done Annie Get Your Gun, I might still be sitting at Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, and I'd probably be a drunk. But, you know, because all of those things that Larry and I did together...
Yes.
You know, I would be stuck, you know, working, and he would be stuck doing something else. So I'm glad it worked that way. It was funny, we took a cruise, well, actually when we were going over to England to do the variety show, they showed Annie Get Your Gun on the shipboard. Mm. And Larry was, you know, I think Larry wouldn't even go to see it, he was so upset. But I went to see the movie, and I came back and I told him, I said, you know, it was not very good. I'm glad I didn't do it. So anyway, that was a part of our life. Things were cut off from me for a long time, too. We had an experience one time. We were booked to do the Arthur Murray show. Mm-hmm. This was out of the blue. And we got to New York. We were so excited because this was the first sort of breakthrough that we'd had. And we got to New York and we rehearsed for a couple of days. And then one day the edict came down is we were cut from the show.
Wow.
Now, this kind of thing was always faceless.
Yes.
Nobody would say who said
or why.
We know what happened is the big muckamucks from up there said they are not hireable.
Wow.
And I got that a couple of times, and Larry got it just blanket.
Right.
But one day, I walked into a rehearsal hall for something. I can't remember what I was doing. And Danny Thomas was there. And I had done my first movie with Danny Thomas was Big City at Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. And I loved Danny. He was a great guy. And he said to me, what are you doing? And I said, well, not much. The next thing I know, I am on Danny Thomas's variety show.
Oh.
He did a whole series of variety show before he did Go Tell Papa or whatever that show was he did. It was a wonderful series. Nothing was ever said, but I know Danny was, you know,
wow,
responsible for that, I'm sure.
Okay, so where are we now? Where Danny Thomas, we're in the 50s, the 60s? Where are we?
Well,
no, we're not in the 60s yet. Are
no,
we?
Well, in the 50s, it was when my kids were born. Well, of course, I'm forgetting that I had quite I figure so on 10 years in New York. I once said, I remember it was very pompous of me to say, I think it'll take me 10 years to become a star. I can't imagine being so, but it did. I came to New York in 1936, and in 1946, I starred in Call Me Mister.
Oh, my God.
Which was, and I had done several Broadway shows before then, mm-hmm. a show called Jackpot, which didn't succeed, a show called Laughing Room Only, which was Olson and Johnson.
Ah, yes.
And what else? Oh, gosh. I did several Broadway shows, and
We have a dog visiting.
Yeah.
Hello, who are you?
This is Ruby.
Hi, Ruby.
Hi, Ruby.
That's all right.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. We have...
That's enough.
We have Doggus Interrupt Us.
Hi.
So in the middle, or rather toward... Larry and I were married in 1944. By that time, I had developed a nightclub act. And then I brought out my act here to California to a club. And that's when Larry and I met through mutual friends. Mm-hmm. And I think it, you know, I don't believe in love at first sight, but it happened.
you don't believe in it?
Yeah, well, you know, Larry was producing a little evening of comedy at the Actors Lab. Mm-hmm. And he asked a friend of his, who also happened to be a friend of mine, if he had a good comedy sketch that he could use in the show. And the guy, whose name was Sam Locke, said, yeah, and the gal who did it on Broadway in New York is here, and I bet she'd do it for you. And so I came and did this comedy sketch at the Actors Lab, and I kept seeing this cute guy hovering around. And he asked me out for a cup of coffee one night, mm-hmm. And he took me to Brittingham's, which was a cafeteria near Columbia, which is a big gathering place for all of the actors from Columbia Pictures. Mm-hmm. And instead of taking me into the cafeteria for coffee, he took me into the cocktail lounge and we ordered champagne.
Oh.
That should have been a sign. And then he took me up and showed me Mulholland Drive. And at one point said to me, "You're the girl I'm going to marry."
Really?
And of course I laughed and I said, "Sure." Yeah. But that was in May, and I shortly after that had an engagement in Chicago, so I had to go to Chicago, and it just happened that Larry's mother lived in Joliet, which is just a stone's throw from Chicago, so he took that opportunity
to go visit his mother.
And then he went back to California, and I went back to New York, and by that time I was playing in Laughing Room Only, I think, the Olsen and Johnson show. Mm-hmm. But I remember my mother saying to me once, "I think you better get married," because I was getting very thin. I wasn't eating. There were a lot of long distance calls to California. So I got on the phone the next day and said, "Were you serious about getting married?" He said, "Yes, when are you coming?"
Uh-huh.
And so my mother and I got on the train. In those days, you didn't fly, you took
right.
the chief and the super chief across the country. So we got married here in Hollywood and I had 1 month of honeymoon. Then I had to go back on the road with the Olsen and Johnson show.
Mm-hmm.
And then a year later, I was cast in Call Me Mister. Mm-hmm. And I was with that for a year. So Larry and I, the first 2 years of our marriage, we were 3,000 miles apart.
Right.
And we would grab, like, Larry would have a week here, and I'd have 2 or 3 days I could fly to California or something. Anyway, we managed. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a good way to start a marriage.
Not a lot
we
of pressure.
Fight.
No, right.
And so in the middle of Call Me Mister, after about a year. It was still running. It was a very big hit. Larry's mother was dying. I just felt, you know, I had to leave Call Me Mister. That was in 1936. So, you know, I was right. 36, that was 1946.
46. Right, right. You were right.
From 1936 to 1946. But that was, I always thought that was pretty egotistical of me to say that.
But it can't be egotistical if it's the truth.
Yeah, right. So then I started under contract to Metro for 5 years, I guess I was under contract. And
then there was that period of time when you and Larry were doing Variety or...
Yeah.
You know.
And Summer Stock.
Right, right.
And Las Vegas and all the things. And during all of this, Lou Mandel was, I think, I try to think, I used to have a word for it. He was always hustling, you know, finding out. And he would confront Samuel Goldwyn and say, "Why don't you put her in this picture, you know?" So, you know, you're right. It was like that sort of, I always feel like I'm sort of drifting and somebody always... gives me something.
Yes.
And I'm agreeable.
It's really very like what your mother did.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And almost as though you have a kind of trust in the process, in the universe, in the fate, or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And it comes through.
Yeah.
Which, again, I've heard this before. There's something really, it's almost, I find myself using this word also for, you know, do you know what it means to be bashert?
What?
Bashert?
No.
It's a Yiddish word,
uh-huh.
And it means meant to be.
Ah.
You know, and it's almost as though for certain people, this thing is just meant to happen, and it is going to happen, you know,
yeah.
they attract it,
yeah.
You know, or...
And also, I mean, I give myself credit. I'm open to
it. I was just going to say, yeah. And whatever it is, you will do
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
You know, and you can do it, whatever yeah, it is.
It's. I feel sometimes it's just plain laziness, but on the other hand, I think it's because. I don't know what it's because. It's not laziness. It's because I feel comfortable about it. I feel comfortable in going a lot of different directions.
How would that be laziness?
Well, because you feel like you didn't instigate it at all. You had nothing to do with it.
You just laid back, right?
and something took care of it, you know? But I'm lucky to have the quality of being able to just accept.
Yeah.
And
see, I think, you know, I think that's an interesting thing. I think that's a myth in our culture. That one would label that or even think or consider that
yeah.
as laziness.
Yeah.
'Cause I think it's hi Ruby. I think it's what you said, the capacity to go with the flow, to,
yeah.
you know, to accept what's being offered. And lazy, my God, it doesn't matter. We're having another visitation from this very sweet dog. Is she a poodle?
No, she's a Bichon Frise.
Oh, yes, she's a Bichon Frise. She's so beautiful. She's just white and fluffy.
She's adorable.
She is absolutely adorable. And now she's done with us. I know how hard you work at everything you do. So, I mean, it's even up to and including that, you know, describing that at night you were learning the steps for
yeah.
the job you were going to have in the daytime, you know, because you just say yes to everything.
Yeah. One of the things I'm most proud of that I feel I did it, you know, I really promoted this and did it myself was the show I just did
yeah.
of all my songs.
Yeah.
You know, I've been having, you know, hiding these songs in trunks and closets and things for years. And the fact that I actually got them out, gave them to people and rehearsed them in the songs and put it on a stage. And, you know, I don't know whether anything will ever happen from it, but
it, yeah.
but I did it.
Yes, yes.
I can't
yes.
believe
well,
I did
well,
it.
What about the book?
You mean the book of... Oh, my book.
Your book.
Yeah. Now, see, that's another thing. I never thought I would write a book. As a matter of fact, the collaborator, Ron Rappaport, had a meeting with me once after seeing my first one-woman show that I did. See, now that was another thing. I was doing this little bits and pieces in workshop and you know, not thinking of doing anything with them but just getting them off my back.
Yeah.
And people kept saying, you got to make a show of this.
Yeah.
And John Carter, who became my director, kept, you know, bugging me, put it together. And I had no intention of doing a show, but it just kind of fell together.
It's the same thing over and over again,
except,
as you say, for the show that you instigated.
One, the one I just did.
Right, and tell the audience how old you are and were when you did this.
Well, I'm now 89, and I was 88 then, and because I told the audience it was a good time to do a musical show because there are 88 keys on the piano. My son Gary told me that, but I think I'm proudest of that because I really got off my behind and did something about it, you know. But I started to say something about the fact that that almost all the things I have done have been because somebody handed them to me on a silver platter, and I said, okay.
Yeah, somebody said, do this.
Yeah.
So how did the television work happen?
Well, that came, that was Lou Mandel. He all in the family, there was a wonderful actress named Seda Thompson mm-hmm. that was originally cast as the next door neighbor mm-hmm. to Archie and Edith. And she was very unhappy, evidently. The first show they did, she was a theater actress,
yes.
and it just bugged her, this whole technique of television, which can be very exhausting and annoying and everything else. Norman Lear, who is a very wise man and a very kind man, instead of holding her to the contract, said, you know, please, if you're unhappy. So I think I had been up for it, been suggested for the part. But then when Seda left, there it was mm-hmm. for me. And Lou Bendel had done a wonderful thing. I think this was even before Seda was cast. They wanted me to come into the office to see them. And Lou said, no, I think you and the writers should come to Betty's home.
Wow.
And, you know, that...
They don't do that.
No. But Norman Lear and the head writer, they all came and they sat in this living room and interviewed me. And that was the kind of thing that Lou did, because he wanted me to be in the position
yeah.
of dignity always.
Yes.
So when Seda Thompson left, then I was automatically in the show. And I was there for 3 years.
And boy, the rest is history
yeah.
for that. That
oh,
was...
I loved that show.
Mm-hmm.
It was...
Well, so did everybody else.
Yeah, and...
I mean, talk about groundbreaking and history-making.
Yeah.
And
Norman Lear is such a smart man and such a progressive man, which I like. But the things he did, some of the subjects he tackled,
mm-hmm.
were so courageous.
Yeah.
The one that I did that I love, the writers called me one day and they said, how would you feel about if your character had breast cancer?
Oh, my goodness.
And I said, listen, I'm an actress. You know, what do you mean?
Mm-hmm.
They said, well, some people would feel very squeamish about it. And I said, no. So they said, well, it's going to be a very funny show. They said, it's the Christmas show. I said, I couldn't imagine. But what it turned out to be was very funny, but very, very meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
Where I don't know whether you remember the scene. There was a scene between Edith and me where Edith reveals that she's going to have to go for a test.
I do remember
this. And she's so afraid that if she, you know, say has to have a mastectomy or something, that that Archie won't love her anymore. And I say, believe me, you know, it's not true. And I reveal the fact that I've had a mastectomy.
Yes.
And we're sitting at the kitchen table and I say to her, don't bother to look. You won't be able to see. But there's a close-up of Edith, and her eyes, she can't help but look down. It's very funny.
Mm-hmm.
But it's at the same time, it was a very meaningful scene.
Oh, yeah.
And that scene has been taken out and shown in many cancer societies mm-hmm. at luncheons and things like that where they want to encourage
make this point.
People.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And then, of course, Laverne and Shirley came along also because somebody was playing the landlady and they weren't happy with her, and all of a sudden they were happy with me. So those things, I didn't really try out for Laverne and Shirley. They just called me. The guy who, one of the writers, I was doing my one-woman show in Westwood, and he came to see it. And I think that's why they decided I'd be good to play the landlady. But, you know, I don't think I even went out for it at all.
Well, in a way, you didn't go out for any of it.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, it all came to you.
It's a
wonderful, wonderful story.
Well,
I'm just curious, Follies. When was Follies? Was in the 90s? Was it? Or was it after?
You know, I can't remember.
Boy, exactly. Neither can I, and I was there.
Because I'd done Meet Me in St. Louis, and that's where Gary met Karen, Hmm. And then a couple of years later, I did Follies. I'm so bad about years. It all
It doesn't matter. How did that happen?
Well, that happened. I was asked to audition. Now, I think that came through an agent. He's not even an agent. It's funny. There's been a guy who used to manage Lee Merriweather. That's how I first met him. Then Lee Merriweather went off and married somebody and was out of the business for a while. And Mark Levin just kind of started hanging around and hustling for me. And we've never signed a contract. That someone will answer that phone.
Yes.
And he
so again, somebody just shows up, right?
Yeah, he was around a lot when Lee was around. And I think he got me the Meet Me in St. Louis job. Then he put me up to audition for Follies. And I met the director, who I just loved, Matthew Warchus, darling little guy from England. And I guess Matthew liked me, so...
Well, you were perfect. Yeah. Oh, my God, you were so perfect.
Yeah. It's funny because, see, that's another thing that is fortunate. I've seen Follies, I don't know how many times, and I've seen it, that number done many different ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And generally, it's done very brash.
Brash, you know? I know.
Way baby.
I know.
And I never saw it that way. And when we started rehearsal, Matthew Ward, just the director, just let me do it the way I felt it.
It was perfect.
And at the end of the number, I don't know whether you remember, I just stood there.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I wouldn't have had the nerve to do this, but Matthew said, don't move. Just stand there, lost in your thoughts, until someone taps you.
Yeah.
I stood there for how many, 10, 15 seconds, and I wouldn't have had nerve to do that.
But it was perfect. And
he directed me to do that, so it was a wonderful moment. And it's funny because I have the poster, I'll show it to you later, on my bedroom door of me standing like that.
Wow.
And many saw the show. The kids came to New York to see my granddaughter. Came to see it, and she saw it, and I heard her one day showing some of her friends that picture, and she said, she's in a trance. I thought that was so great, that she interpreted that, I thought, just right, she's in a trance.
And she was right. She was right. It was so beautiful. Well, all right, my God, I haven't made you talk for such a long time.
Well, I love to talk about myself.
Well, it's
my favorite subject.
Well, and you are fortunate to have a really wonderful subject to talk about. So let me just ask you, if thinking about your career and making a life as a performer, if there's anything that I haven't asked you or that you'd like to say, or
Well, we were talking before about, I don't feel like I devote the time to my kids that my mother was able to devote to me. However, I've sort of rationalized it this way, and I think I'm right. I've given them the gift of my independence. Mm-hmm. My mother sat in that table there, on the dinette table, all the time. And it used to break my heart because she had nothing else but me.
Yes.
And I don't think that's right. I think it was too bad that she, because she was a very intelligent, bright woman. And I think it's better for my kids to have a mother and a grandma who's active and has her own interests, so that it's not concentrated on them.
I could not agree more. And also, when you do that, you give permission to the kids to follow their dream, to be themselves, not to have to worry about accommodating someone else's needs. Mm. I couldn't agree more. I think that's absolutely
one
right.
One of the lyrics of the song that I have in my show, that the song that my son wrote the music to, it's called Remember Me, and one of the lyrics is, love is not a thing to keep or to hide away. Love is not a thing asleep. It's yours to give away. So take my love and pass it on. They in turn will pass it on. That's the way I'd like you to remember me.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful, and it's, I think, the perfect way to end this interview. Thank you so much.
So that's Betty Garrett. I know you can hear from this interview how remarkably accomplished she is, you know, how much she can do and has done. I'm not sure that you can hear from this interview something that's equally true about Betty, and that is that she is one of the most generous human beings on the planet. And certainly what all of us who have had the honor to know her will take from this relationship is her gift of kindness and love. That's, of course, in addition to all of the pleasure from her extraordinary talent. I'm going to play one more cut from that compilation of music put out by Betty over the years. This is the first cut on the CD, and it's called Everything I've Got. It was written by Richard Rodgers and Lorenz Hart, and it's from a play called By Jupiter, and we have Betty Garrett and Milton Berle, and it was recorded in March of 1947. So here, a very young Betty Garrett and a very young Milton Berle.
Oh, Betty G.
Yes, Milton B.
Gee, you look awful pretty.
Thank you.
It's a lovely hat you're wearing. What did it cost you?
$55.
$55? Are you kidding? You could have got a new one for that.
How dare you?
Don't stamp your foot at me. That's impolite. To stamp your foot at me is not quite right. All I discover is you're not so fine. I fear my lover is a swine. I have eyes for you to give you dirty looks. I have words that do not come from children's books. There's a trick with a knife I'm learning to do. And everything I've got belongs to you. I've a powerful anesthesia in my fist.
You mean in your head.
And the perfect wrist to give your neck a twist.
Don't you try to make up with me.
There are hammerlock holes. I've mastered a few.
Not with your muscles.
And everything I've got belongs to you.
Share for share.
Share alike.
You get struck each time I strike. You for me.
Me for you.
I'll give you plenty of nothing.
I'm not yours for better, but for worse.
Worse is right.
And I've learned to give the well-known witch's curse.
You know, you look like one.
I've a terrible tongue, a temper for two.
For ten.
And everything I've ever got belongs to you. Let's hear from you.
I have eyes for you to give you dirty looks.
Which one, the good one?
I have words that do not come from children's books.
The ones that abandon Boston.
There's a trick with a knife I'm learning to do. And everything I've got belongs to you. I've a powerful anesthesia in my fist.
In my fist, she says, in my fist.
And the perfect wrist to give your neck a twist. There are hammerlock holes, I've mastered a few.
What are you, a lady wrestler?
And everything I've got belongs to you.
Share for share.
Share alike.
You get struck each time I strike.
You for me, me for you.
I'll give you plenty of nothing.
I'm not yours for better, but for worse. And I've learned to give the well-known witch's curse.
Whatever happened to Spike Jones?
I've a terrible tongue, a temper for two.
And everything I've got belongs to, everything I've got belongs to, everything I've got belongs to you.
There you have it, Betty Garrett and Milton Berle, 62 years ago. Just terrific. It is so wonderful that someone went to all the trouble of collecting all of these songs that feature Betty, and not only Milton Berle, but if you were listening last week, Jimmy Durante, also, of course, Betty's husband, Larry Parks, Gene Kelly is on it. It's just full of interesting, funny, delightful songs. And if you want to get it, the CD is available. So if you go up on my website, thelinshow.com, and you click on Contact Me, and remember that's L-Y-N-N-E, thelinshow.com, and you click on Contact Me, then I will either put you in touch with Betty or get the CD for you. I will somehow facilitate your getting this piece of history. So I have just enough time to thank Josh Hackney, as I always do. He gets up out of bed after carousing on New Year's Eve. He's here for me no matter what, when my glitches overtake me, and even just to come and make sure that the sound of this show is as good as it can be. Thank you, Josh. And again, same deal. If you have any problems with computers, electronics, recording, and oops, sorry about that, and you want Josh, just go up on my website and say, I want Josh, and I'll find him for you. So, as always, I hope that you heard something that you can use in this show, or something that entertained or amused you. I'm sure that you did, actually. Anyway, something that brings you back, because I will be here next week, same time, same station, and I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older, my hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring, I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot, my time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly, well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get, I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight, no, no. We will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper, singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me I may have gotten limper, but I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang.
called the Humphrey Bogart Rumba. And if you listen through to the end, you will actually hear Humphrey speaking. So here is the Humphrey Bogart Rumba with Betty Garrett.
Humphrey Bogart, Humphrey Bogart. This is the Humphrey Bogart Rumba, 'cause Humphrey Bogart is the star we admire. But if you do not care for Humphrey Bogart, then name it after any star that you desire. Mickey Rooney, Errol Flynn, Jennifer Jones or Gable, Gloria to Haven, Evelyn Keyes, Harry James or Grable, Judy Garland, Janet Lee, Crosby or Myrtle Long, Frank Sinatra, Larry Parks, or Mrs. Jolson's boy. This is the Humphrey Bogart Rumba. They play it every night at Slapsies and Cyril's. But if you do not care for Humphrey Bogart, then you can call up the Lucille Ball, John Lund or Danny Kaye. No matter what you may say, it's still Humphrey Bogart Rumba.
This is the Humphrey Bogart Rumba.
Humphrey's the toughest man upon the screen.
Humphrey Bogart is the star we admire.
Humphrey's the toughest man I've ever seen.
If you do not care for Humphrey,
I'll moit it a bum that don't like Humphrey. Gardner, Keenan Wynn, Deborah Carr or Crawford, maybe Red Skelton, Gregory Peck, Johnson Kelly or Lawford, Janie Powell, June Allison, Ricardo Montalban, Esther Williams, Dinah Shore, or even Betty Garrett. Never mind. This is the Humphrey Bogart Rumba. They play it every night at Slapsies and Zeros. But if you do not care for Humphrey Bogart, then you can call it the Johnny Dog, Bob Hope or Turhan Bay, or call it the Lauren Bacall or the Laurence Olivier. No matter what you may say, it's still the Humphrey Bogart Rumba.
All right, everybody, let's dance.
Humphrey Bogart!